Okay, let's resume the narrative then from where we broke off there with James's dispensing power having been declared legal, which, as I said, gave him the green light to pursue his policy of re-Catholicizing the nation. So, 13 Roman Catholics were sworn in as members of the King's Privy Council. Anglican Tories who objected were dismissed. James seemed to go out of his way, indeed, to flaunt his Catholicism now in the face of his people. He built royal Catholic chapels at Whitehall and Windsor. He set up a new Catholic printing press in Oxford. The royal printers in London and York became Catholics and began printing Catholic books. Catholics were put in charge of the armed forces and the civil service. Anglican clergy were forbidden to preach against Catholicism. James tightened the screws on the universities as well. He appointed a Catholic as head of University College, Cambridge, with a Jesuit chaplain who celebrated the Mass in public. Another Catholic was made head of the Oxford Cathedral College of Christ Church. In February 1687, James ordered the Vice-Chancellor of Cambridge University to confer a degree on a Benedictine monk, Alban Francis. But Francis declined to take the customary academic oaths. They were Protestant in language. James insisted that Francis must receive the degree without the oaths. The university vice-chancellor, John Peachel, refused. Peachel was sacked after being bullied in public hearings by the infamous Judge Jeffreys. The public outcry against James' actions was great. Anti-Catholic pamphlets and treatises gushed from Protestant printing presses. James, therefore, tried to divide the Protestant opposition by cloaking his pro-Catholic policy in a general goodwill to non-Anglicans. In April 1687, he issued a declaration of indulgence, suspending all discriminatory laws against Protestant nonconformists, as well as Roman Catholics. Perhaps the nonconformists could be won over, and a Catholic nonconformist alliance against Anglican intolerance might shore up James's throne. Although nonconformists took advantage of the indulgence to worship freely, most of them remained very suspicious of James' motives. Two of the foremost Presbyterians, Richard Baxter and John Howe, went so far as to denounce the indulgence as unconstitutional. But James pressed ahead. One of the most controversial of his acts, following hot on the heels of the indulgence, was to dismiss from Magdalen College, Oxford, its entire governing body, the Fellows, of whom there were 25, for refusing to have a royally chosen Catholic as head of the college. They'd already elected an Anglican. James forcibly replaced all the Fellows with Catholics. A venerable college of Oxford University, the home of Anglican learning, a nursery of Anglican piety, had been transformed into a virtual seminary for training Catholic priests. Anglicans were transfixed with horror. James also outraged the Tory landowners. They no longer trusted him, so he could no longer rely on Tory magistrates to do his bidding. The king therefore carried out a purge, replacing the magistrates drawn from traditional Tory families with compliant non-entities of his own choosing, some of whom were Catholic or non-conformist. The purge sent howls of anguish through the entire Tory establishment. It also led to absurd scenes, for example in Newcastle, where James appointed a Catholic mayor and a non-conformist council. The council loathed the papist mayor and kept voting against his every attempt to present an official declaration of loyalty to James. The alliance between James and Tory Anglicanism was clearly at an end. Since the Whigs were still implacably opposed to James, it left the king with almost no friends in the entire English political class. In August, the leading Tory Anglican politician, George Savile, Marquess of Halifax, wrote a best-selling response to the royal indulgence of February. This was Halifax's Letter to a Dissenter, in which he famously told nonconformists concerning James's advances to them, "You are therefore to be hugged now, only that you may the better be squeezed at another time." Most nonconformists found Halifax's argument all too plausible and refused any alliance with James. James's position was further undermined by another best-selling pamphlet published in November by Gaspar Fagel, the chief magistrate of Holland, most powerful of the Dutch Republic's provinces. Fagel was acting on behalf of William of Orange, the Calvinist Republic's Stadthalter. holder or highest federal official. William's stake in the English scene was his marriage to James's Protestant daughter Mary, which meant that if James died without a son, Mary would inherit the English throne. In the November letter, Fagel publicised the fact that William and Mary both disapproved of James' proposed abolition of the 1673 Test Act, which prevented Catholics from holding office. It was hinted they also disapproved of his declaration of indulgence. The pamphlet's message spread like wildfire. By 1688, some 55,000 copies had been sold. English Protestants began looking overseas to William of Orange as their great hope of deliverance. In April 1688, James reissued his Declaration of Indulgence. This time, he ordered the clergy of the established church to read it out from their pulpits. Here was a crisis of principle. Ever since the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, Anglican clergy had extolled the virtue of passive obedience to the reigning monarch. Yet now their monarch was commanding them to act as his agents in promulgating a decree which they believed to be aimed at the destruction of their church. They had little doubt that it was a mere cover for the further promotion of Roman Catholicism. Many of them also doubted its legality. Could the king ride roughshod over Parliament in this manner by suspending its laws? Was Parliament not part of the constitution as well as the monarchy? Had it not been the Cavalier Parliament that had restored the Anglican Church in 1662? James was sure that the spineless clergy would obey and read out the indulgence. He had a rude awakening. Seven of the bishops, including Archbishop William Sancroft of Canterbury, handed in a petition to James asking to be excused from reading the indulgence. Several other leading Anglican clergy, who didn't have bishoprics, also signed the petition, and Henry Compton, the militantly Protestant Bishop of London, would have signed, but James had already suspended him from his episcopal functions for his outspoken opposition to royal Romanizing. Enraged, James had the seven bishops arrested and tried for seditious libel. Meanwhile, those Anglican clergy who did read the indulgence from the pulpit found that their congregations walked out in protest. Although the indulgence gave freedom to Protestant nonconformists as well as Catholics, even the great majority of nonconformists opposed the king's declaration. They believed it was unconstitutional and that its real aim was the re-establishment of Catholicism. The Calvinistic Baptist leader, William Kiffin, advised churches that shared his faith to make a pragmatic use of their newfound liberty, but to offer no thanks to James, since his motives were bad and the indulgence was unlawful. Presbyterian leader Richard Baxter employed the freedom the king had given him by preaching a sermon praising the seven imprisoned bishops for their heroic Christian defiance of a papist tyrant. Perhaps for the first and last time in English history, Anglican bishops were popular heroes. The indulgence, therefore, brought no great rallying of nonconformity to James. Paradoxically, it had the opposite effect. Most nonconformists rallied to the Anglicans, who were suffering for their rejection of the indulgence. Anglicans responded in kind and began speaking of toleration for nonconformists being lawfully enacted by a free Protestant parliament. It seemed that the differences between Anglican and nonconformists had now melted away in united Protestant opposition to a greater enemy, Rome, personified in James. The trial of the seven bishops was held on June the 29th. On June the 30th, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty. England went wild with celebration. James was stunned and deeply mortified. On the night of the verdict, seven leaders of the opposition to James, including Bishop Compton of London, signed a letter addressed to William of Orange, pleading with him to land in England with his Dutch army and save the liberties of an endangered Protestant people. The letter had even more urgency than it would otherwise have had, owing to the birth of a son to James on June the 10th. This meant that James now had his own male heir to the throne. He already had a grown-up daughter. Of course, Mary, the wife of William of Orange, but a daughter hardly counted in those days. The horrifying prospect of a Catholic dynasty drove almost every English Protestant into a state of dread. that was prepared to act in a revolutionary manner to preserve a Protestant England. If it took a Dutch Calvinist army to deliver the land, so be it. William of Orange's motive had in reality nothing to do with English liberty, or not specifically. He had only one objective in his life, to destroy the ambitions of Louis XIV to control Europe in the interests of Catholic France. William feared an alliance between Louis and James. James had thus far held back, anxious that such an alliance would alienate his people. But William was taking no chances. He may even have secured the blessing or acquiescence of Pope Innocent XI. Innocent was as opposed to Louis XIV as William was, because of the French king's assumption of power over the Catholic Church in France. Indeed, the Pope had only recently excommunicated Louis for his Henry VIII-like tyranny over the Church. The spectacle of an alliance between William of Orange and the Pope boggles the mind, if one thinks of the religious politics of Northern Ireland today. Then William waited for a favourable wind. When it finally came, on November the 1st, William's fleet set sail for England, 600 ships carrying 15,000 troops. Meanwhile, a strong tide of anti-James feeling had been flowing in England. The rank and file of his army were turning against him. So James brought over a contingent of Irish Catholic soldiers. This merely made things worse. Anti-James riots broke out. William's troops landed at Tor Bay on November the 5th. There they waited. There was no general uprising. The people of the southwestern counties had been too traumatized by their experience during Monmouth's rebellion to take any further insurrectionary action. But William did not need to do anything. He simply published a manifesto, disclaiming any intention of conquest, assuring everyone that he'd come purely at the invitation of England's civil and spiritual leaders, denouncing James's unconstitutional acts, and calling for a free parliament to resolve the nation's grievances. James ordered his unreliable army to Salisbury, but some of the foremost English nobles had declared for William. The top Tory statesman, Thomas Osborne, Earl of Danby, one of the seven who had signed the letter of invitation to William, had mobilised the northern counties against James and captured York. The top Whig statesman, William Cavendish, Duke of Devonshire, who had also signed the invitation, had mobilised the Midlands. On November the 24th, James' most loyal servant and most capable general, the Tory aristocrat John Churchill, defected from the Salisbury army to William, together with 400 officers and men. James lost his nerve and resolved on flight. He was consumed with fear that he might meet the same fate as his father, Charles I, executed by his own people. The fugitive king was captured by a Protestant mob at Faversham and carried back a prisoner to Whitehall. But William's Dutch troops liberated the fallen monarch and allowed him to escape to France. William judged it best to have James out of the way. Once James had left England, the members of the House of Lords, together with those who had been elected MPs in the Commons under Charles II, acting as representatives of the country, entrusted William with its administration. He arranged for a general election to send delegates to a convention, a special parliament to settle England's political and religious affairs. The convention parliament met on January the 22nd, 1689. After intense debate, Parliament finally declared that since James had abandoned his country, the English throne was now vacant. On this, Whigs and Tories were agreed after much boggling by the Tories. They were not agreed, however, on a solution to the vacancy. Whigs wanted to give William the crown. Tories preferred to make him a regent, ruling, theoretically, in the name of James II's newborn son, so that the strictest principle of hereditary monarchy from father to son would be preserved. There was one problem, however, with the Tory solution. William would not accept it. If he was to govern England, he wanted a free hand. He must be king. The Tories finally caved in. On the 11th of April, Bishop Compton of London crowned William and Mary as joint monarchs of England. William's claim to the throne was through Mary, as daughter of James II, not quite as good as a son, but adequate. They were crowned on condition that they accepted a Bill of Rights. Among other things, the bill prohibited Roman Catholics from occupying the throne, declared illegal the monarch's power to suspend the operation of laws passed by Parliament, and made parliamentary freedom of speech absolute. No MP could ever be prosecuted for anything said in Parliament. William and Mary's acceptance of the Bill of Rights extinguished any idea of absolute monarchical authority in England. They ruled under a constitution. These events collectively are known in English history as the Glorious Revolution. Glorious because bloodless. The religious settlement of 1689 brought an end at last to the persecution of nonconformists. As a reward for their refusal to ally themselves with James, they were now given legal freedom to worship in the Toleration Act of May 1689. The Conventicle Act of 1664 and the 5 Mile Act of 1665 were both repealed. Now, there were conditions. The Act did not apply to anti-Trinitarians, only to Presbyterians, Independents, Baptists and Quakers who all confessed the Trinity. Unitarians would have to wait until the year 1813 before Parliament granted them legal toleration. To obtain the benefits of the Act, those of Presbyterian, Independent and Baptist persuasion had to subscribe to the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church, except those parts dealing with church government and, for Baptists, the Article on Baptism. The leading nonconformist, Richard Baxter, published a treatise, Mr. Baxter's Sense of the Articles, to enable nonconformists who still had scruples about some of the 39 articles to sign them with a good conscience. Quakers were totally exempt from allegiance to the 39 articles. They merely had to declare their faith in the Trinity and the inspiration of the Bible. Nonconformists also had to swear allegiance to the reigning monarch and subscribe to a statement rejecting the doctrine of transubstantiation. On complying with these terms, nonconformists became as fully legally protected as Anglicans in their worship. The new freedom was immediately exploited by nonconformists, and hundreds of new chapels were built and new congregations founded. Nonconformists were required to register their places of worship with the civil authorities, and they weren't allowed to bar anyone from their meetings, but disturbing nonconformist worship now became a criminal offence. There was, however, no lifting of the civil restrictions on nonconformists. They still could not hold public office, and therefore not sit as MPs, nor send their sons to Oxford or Cambridge. This exclusion from the political and educational life of the national establishment, however, was not quite as galling as it may sound. Some nonconformists could and did sit as MPs by occasionally taking Holy Communion in the Anglican Church, thus getting round the Corporation Act of 1662 and the Test Act of 1673. Even where they didn't have a nonconformist MP, nonconformists could rely implicitly on the Whigs to safeguard their interests in Parliament. The Whigs became the political voice of nonconformity, while the Tories were the political voice of Anglicanism. As for Oxford and Cambridge, well, nonconformists could get an equal or superior education at a good dissenting academy, to the vexation of envious Anglicans. One restriction that remained on nonconformists that was genuinely galling: they still had a legal obligation to pay tithes to the Anglican Church. Tithes had a long and complicated future ahead of them in England, Wales, Scotland and Ireland. Now, permit me to draw to a conclusion by offering cameos of arguably the three most abidingly influential nonconformist pastor theologians from our period. And as Providence would have it, they are a Presbyterian, an Independent, and a Baptist. First of all, then, the Presbyterian, Richard Baxter. Baxter is probably the most famous Puritan of all. Born at Rowton in Shropshire, he never studied at university. His schoolmaster advised against it, and sent him to study under a friend at Ludlow Castle. Consequently, Baxter was largely self-taught. What he lacked in university education, he more than compensated for in the vast extent of his private reading and the subtle genius of his intellect. A spiritual awakening in his teens partly through reading Richard Sibbes' The Bruised Reed, turned Baxter's thoughts at length to the ministry, and he was ordained by the Bishop of Worcester in 1638. From 1641, he was in charge of Kidderminster Parish Church in Worcestershire. When the Civil War broke out, Baxter's mild Puritanism put him on the parliamentary side. But Worcester was royalist, and Baxter had to flee. He ended up a chaplain in the parliamentary army, where he strove to mitigate the radical religious and political views that were spreading among the soldiers. Ever the moderate, Baxter opposed the alliance between English parliamentarians and Scottish Covenanters, the execution of the king, and the rise to power of Oliver Cromwell. His verdict on Cromwell was very ambiguous. "I did in open conference declare Cromwell and his adherents to be guilty of treason and rebellion, aggravated by perfidiousness and hypocrisy. But yet I did not think it my duty to rave against him in the pulpit, or to do this so unseasonably and imprudently as might irritate him to mischief. And the rather because, as he kept up his approbation of a godly life in general, and of all that was good, except that which the interest of his sinful cause engaged him to be against, so I perceived that it was his design to do good in the main, and to promote the gospel and the interests of godliness, more than any had done before him, except in those particulars which were against his own interest." Baxter finally returned to Kidderminster around 1647, His preaching and pastoral visitation over the following decade revolutionised the moral and spiritual state of the parish. His preaching had a matchless power. A 19th century biographer commented that by his sermons, Baxter drew more hearts to the great broken heart than any single Englishman of his age. When the monarchy was restored in 1660, with Baxter's influential voice assisting, Charles II offered him the bishopric of Hereford, but he declined, owing to dissatisfaction with Anglican episcopacy. He was driven from the church and from Kidderminster, becoming a leading nonconformist. Usually classified as a Presbyterian, Baxter's views on church government were really too eclectic to fit into any system, but he was more closely identified with Presbyterians than with any other group. He suffered grievous persecution for his nonconformity, especially under the infamous Judge Jeffreys in 1685. He lived to see the overthrow of James II by William of Orange and rejoiced in it. His autobiography, The Reliquiae Baxterianae, is one of the most important and readable primary sources for the whole period of the Civil War and Restoration. Baxter's legacy is huge. He wrote more than any other Puritan, perhaps more than any other English author. A collected works would fill 60 volumes. Penned in plain, vigorous English, his spiritual writings have been richly prized from that day to this. Call to the Unconverted, Causes and Danger of Slighting Christ and His Gospel, The Divine Life, The Life of Faith, Now or Never, A Saint or a Brute, A Treatise of Conversion, A Treatise of Self-Denial. These are the finest flower of Puritan practical divinity. Three of Baxter's works merit particular attention. The Reformed Pastor is the universally acknowledged Puritan classic on the work of the ministry. The Christian Directory is the masterpiece of Puritan ethics. And The Saint's Everlasting Rest, composed after Baxter had almost died of a nosebleed, is an extended meditation on heaven, which ranks among the most affecting treatments of the subject ever written. Baxter's more doctrinally oriented works have proven more problematic for most mainstream Calvinists because of Baxter's massive independence of thought. As often as he expounded Reformed orthodoxy, he just as often stepped outside of it, offering his own Baxterian interpretation of law and gospel, the nature and extent of the atonement, assurance, perseverance, and other themes. So to the independent, or congregationalist, John Owen. Owen is the most well-known doctrinal theologian among the Puritans. Born at Stadhampton in Oxfordshire, he studied at Queen's College, Oxford, receiving his Master of Arts degree in 1635, and he was then ordained as an Anglican deacon and began studying theology. But he left Oxford University in 1637, disillusioned with the high church Arminian theology and worship that Oxford was embracing. Once the Civil War broke out, Owen, a parliamentarian, became, in 1642, Minister of Fordham Parish in Essex, and then in 1646 moved to Coggeshall. By the time he went there, his views on church government had developed from Presbyterianism to independency. He continued, however, to function within the parish system, now controlled by Parliament. Owen's preaching and the theological writings that had begun to flow from his pen brought him increasingly into the public eye. As an independent, he was appreciated by the leaders of the army. When Charles I was put to death, the Rump Parliament chose Owen to preach to them the following day. Although he did not specifically mention the king's execution, the sermon was entitled Religious Zeal Encouraged by Divine Protection. Owen enjoyed high favour throughout the period of the English Republic. He accompanied Cromwell as chaplain on his Irish expedition of 1649 and his invasion of Scotland in 1650. In 1651, Cromwell made Owen Dean of Christ Church Cathedral in Oxford, and then in 1652, he became Vice-Chancellor of the University. He was a dominating figure at the Savoy Assembly of 1658, where English independents adopted a modified Westminster Confession as their own doctrinal statement. When Oliver Cromwell died in 1658, Owen acted as an intermediary between Oliver's son Richard, the new Lord Protector, and the leaders of the army, who preferred a pure republic with no powerful figurehead. The republicanism of the army prevailed, and Richard Cromwell was forced to resign. Many blamed Owen as the chief villain in Richard Cromwell's fall. It might be better to say he played a part. Eventually, however, it was not the English Republic, but the Stuart monarchy that was restored in 1660, and Owen was stripped of his civil and ecclesiastical offices. He spent the rest of his life as a non-conforming independent, ministering from 1666 to a London congregation where many old officers of the army worshipped. Owen's theology fills 24 volumes, 16 on doctrinal or practical divinity, and the other 8 an exhaustive commentary on the letter to the Hebrews. He was probably the supreme English representative of mature Reformed orthodoxy. Although he wrote no systematic theology, his treatment of different topics was comprehensive and cogent, although his style is generally criticised as cumbersome. Much of Owen's writing is in the key of controversy with others, notably Richard Baxter, Anglicans, Roman Catholics, Arminians and Socinians, thereby giving a very illuminating insight into the self-understanding of Puritanism in the post-Civil War era. Owen's practical divinity has been as cherished as his doctrine. The two are fused together to beautiful effect in his treatise of Communion with God the Father, Son and Holy Ghost, an invitation to the feast of Trinitarian spirituality. After the monarchy was restored in 1660, amid persecution, Owen offered a nationwide leadership to independents that was crucial in preserving their faith and their morale in a dark time. And then finally, the Baptist, John Bunyan. Now, the details of Bunyan's early life are very obscure and matters of debate. We know he was born in Elstow, Bedfordshire, of poor parents, that he was a tinker and or brazier by trade, and that he fought in the Civil War, although it's not certain on which side. His marriage to a godly woman, we don't even know her name, in 1649, brought him new spiritual impulses. His wife gave him to read Lewis Bailey's Practice of Piety, a gem of Puritan literature, and another classic, Arthur Dent's Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven. By 1653, Bunyan had experienced assurance of salvation after a frightful struggle described in his autobiography. He was, probably, baptised by John Gifford, pastor of an independent church in Bedford, which Bunyan joined. The church seems to have tolerated both infant baptism and believer's baptism. Its theology was generally Calvinist, and Bunyan himself a Calvinistic Baptist. In 1655, Bunyan began preaching. Few could equal him in captivating his listeners. The restoration of the monarchy and the Anglican Church in 1660 brought persecution, and Bunyan was imprisoned for unlicensed preaching. He spent most of the period, 1660 to 72, in Bedford Prison. Conditions, however, were sufficiently tolerable for Bunyan to write, and it was from the prison that he produced his first masterpiece, Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, in 1666. This was a vivid, graphic account of his pilgrimage to Christ, and a classic in the genre of spiritual autobiography. If he had written nothing else, Bunyan might be remembered for this. But in 1678, he published Pilgrim's Progress, and English literature would never quite be the same again. Bunyan's allegory of the soul's journey through the wilderness of this world to heaven was a phenomenal bestseller. Between 1678 and 1688, the year Bunyan died, more than 11 authorised editions of the book appeared in Britain. It was also published in America and translated into Welsh, French and Dutch. It owed its popularity in part to the simplicity, immediacy and descriptive power of its prose, in part to the succession of colourful characters that populate its pages, and the way Bunyan captures the style of ordinary speech in what he makes them say. Beyond that, the very figure of the individual struggling to fulfil his destiny in an uncomprehending world has a universal human appeal. The story is also imbued with orthodox Protestant theology, seeping out sometimes in direct statement, sometimes in symbol and parable. Bunyan wrote other godly fiction, a second part of Pilgrim's Progress in 1684. Parts 1 and 2 were always published separately until 1728. The Life and Death of Mr. Badman in 1680 and The Holy War in 1682. Most of Bunyan's writings, however, were works of doctrinal and practical divinity in a more typical mould. When Bunyan died, he'd already achieved literary immortality. What John Owen said of Bunyan's preaching has found its echo in the response of millions to Bunyan's writing. Could I possess that tinker's abilities for preaching, I would gladly relinquish all my learning. So there it is, the Puritans and their heirs and sympathisers spent the better part of three decades in the fiery furnace of persecution. Thankfully for us, much spiritual gold was refined in that furnace, and the treasures are ours today. So may the refiner himself help us to value our treasures and become rich ourselves. Now that's the end of the talk. Shall I progress down here now for questions and answers? Mm.